Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. For decades, Washington adhered to what has been called the One China policy, and that included Taiwan. For better or worse, it has kept the peace in the region. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan puts this into question. Is the Biden administration needlessly and recklessly provoking China? Crosstalking Taiwan, I'm joined by my guest, Andy Mok in Beijing. He is a senior research fellow at the Center for China and Globalization. In Hong Kong, we have Angelo Giuliano. He is a political and financial analyst. And in Lake Jackson, we have Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, let me go to you first. I mean, I said it all in my introduction. Is the Biden administration abandoning the One China policy that was, it's been around since 1979, no one was happy with it, but no one was particularly unhappy with it as well. I mean, both sides had a sense of an agreement. Is that a done deal?
Well, I mean, this is just typical of what we're seeing as the Biden administration's foreign policy. It seems to be a foreign policy of go around the world and kick everyone in the face to see what happens. And that's exactly what's happening here. There seems to be no strategic purpose for the U.S. Changing its tune toward China, other than the fact that the Democrats are facing very dire electoral prospects here in just a couple of months. I think the move had a lot to do with politics, but it was also a very boneheaded move, which I'm sure we'll get into later.
Andy, let me go to you in Beijing. I mean, if I were sitting in Beijing, I'd say, what is going on here? What prompted this apparent change in policy? And what was the visit supposed to achieve? I mean, I've always said, a trip, okay, what do you want to do? Enact what kind of policy? That is left completely empty. We have no idea, other than it was just a stunt. And you don't do stunts like that in a very sensitive area of the world. So, I mean, from your perspective there in Beijing, how do you see things?
Well, Peter, I certainly hope that, as Daniel said, that it does turn out to be a stunt or some farewell tour for an over-the-hill politician. But I think a darker and perhaps alternative and realistic explanation of this is that this is a consistent repudiation of the cornerstone of China-U.S. relations. And this puts us on a very, very dangerous path that I've described as the equivalent of the July crisis that served as the prelude to World War I.
Well, that's it. I mean, the guns of August here, this is something that I've talked about earlier in the week here. Angela, let me go to you in Hong Kong. I mean, the One China policy works. So if it works, why fix it? I just don't get it here, okay? And what was the catalyst for this? Because Blinken can say something, Biden can say something, of course, Nancy, if she's coherent. I mean, but believing their words is not enough anymore. Actions speak more than words. Go ahead in Hong Kong.
Well, I'm not surprised. Those plans are done well ahead. We are talking about decades. You can see reports from the RAND Corporation in 2016. They're already talking about how they can contain China. Now there's an acceleration. The RAND Corporation document says clearly that there's a window of opportunity where the U.S. can contain China. And that window of opportunity is between 2015 to 2025. After that, it would be very difficult, almost impossible to contain China. So the U.S. government is under pressure. So they're using Pelosi. They say, well, she went on her own and so on. Do not buy into this. She was actually the right candidate because they can shift the blame on her. But if you look, there's a consistent track record of undermining the One China policy. And the ultimate goal is to contain China. The same as you have RAND Corporation papers, they were talking about long ago how to contain Russia.
You know, Daniel, do you see a parallel to Ukraine with this? Because you and I have talked extensively on this program about Ukraine. And on December 17th, Russia sent a note to NATO and to the United States saying, this is a red line. This is the terms and conditions. You are aware of our intentions now. And they completely blew it off. And they're like blowing this off as well. Is it, oh, it's just Nancy on her farewell tour? I mean, no. I mean, that's not good enough. And if I were the Chinese, I wouldn't accept that as well. Go ahead, Daniel.
That's exactly what I was thinking, is all the parallels to Ukraine. And there certainly are so many of them. And I agree with a lot of what your speaker, I'm sorry, I can't recall his name, from Hong Kong, said. I think that's a great analysis. However, this is the gang that can't shoot straight, right? So them carrying out a RAND study would be like me doing rocket science or something. You know, it's just not going to happen. That may be the goal of some pencil necks, involved. But the people who are carrying this out can't do it. The parallels are there, and they're actually sort of even spooky. Ukraine was dependent on Russia for its economic growth, for trade. It had a potential back in 2014 of really developing a meaningful relationship with Russia and further developing its economy, which has stalled since the end of the Cold War. The same is true with Taiwan and China. As your other guests know better than I'm sure, Taiwan depends on mainland China. It's its primary export market. Taiwan imports, I think, something like 90% of its energy, 98% of its energy. It needs China next door to be a trading partner. And the U.S. again came in, as it did with Ukraine in 2014, and said, oh, yeah, we're going to destroy this relationship. And what do you get in return? Nothing. You get some promises from Nancy Pelosi. You take those to the bank, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, trying to make sense of it is very difficult. Andy, I'm going to be a little provocative right now. Well, if the Biden administration is walking away from the one China policy, so China can too. I mean, it's kind of a get out of jail free card. OK, you want to adhere to it. Why should Beijing? Go ahead.
Well, this is a very complex, dangerous situation, Peter. So the cornerstone of China-U.S. relations is Taiwan and the Taiwan policy, the one China policy, the one China principle. So I don't think that China would walk away. The issue here is this. I completely agree that there are parallels between the Ukraine situation and the Taiwan situation, in that the U.S. is looking to use both as a proxy to contain those that it sees as an adversary. The difference, though, is that Taiwan intrinsically is also the linchpin for American hegemony, not just in the Pacific, but globally, in that whoever possesses Taiwan, well, if think about the two alternatives. If the U.S. wins, we can see an independent Taiwan, American military bases in Taiwan, and that would constrain China dramatically. On the other hand, if Taiwan reunifies with China militarily, peacefully, that changes the global landscape as well. So this is a very, very important juncture for China-U.S. relations and the world. And in this way, it's a little bit different from the Ukraine. But I think it is the same, in that the U.S. is looking to use either the Ukraine or Taiwan as a proxy to contain those it sees as an adversary.
Yeah, well, Angela, I mean, with all what's going on in Ukraine, and it's not going well for the Ukrainians, it's not going well for NATO, it's not going well for the Biden administration, so they want to mess with China now. I mean, do you see any logic to this other than the U.S. is just terrified of losing its hegemony, and it's lashing out all over the globe? Go ahead, in Hong Kong.
It is a desperate move. It's panicking. It's an empire that is panicking. It's saying actually that things are moving on the BRICS, the non-aligned world. You have the world that actually is aligned behind China and Russia, and they're panicking because there's a new world order, especially economically. There's a de-dollarization ahead, and this will accelerate the collapse of the West. So this is a last move. What they want to do, there's a parallel. Well, you see, in Ukraine, they wanted to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. What could happen, what they hope to achieve in the region, is to fight China to the last Taiwanese. And then not only Taiwanese might actually actually lose their lives. You might have actually Japanese to move in. And this is not only a containment of China. This is, if this happened, it could be a containment of all Southeast Asia and the whole global South actually will actually suffer from that.
Well, you know, Daniel, again, you know, kind of the same question I had for Andy. I mean, if the U.S. isn't going to adhere by this policy of one China, then I think all bets are off. And the Chinese will say, look, I mean, you're not a reliable partner, so we're going to have to go out on our own, much like what the Russians had to do. I know that goes down to a path of potential conflict. But, I mean, if you can't believe your interlocutors in Washington, then what are you supposed to do, Daniel?
Exactly. And I think it's yet another own goal by the United States, yeah, because it's essentially the U.S. who said now, hey, the rules are off, as you said. And so the Chinese said, OK, that sounds fine. Mainland China says, that's fine. Here's our military exercises. We're no longer going to abide by the central line. We're no longer going to abide by the sort of agreements that we had that weren't set down. And we're going to start doing sanctions. I think I read that one of the sanctions on the export of sand to Taiwan. Well, that's a big deal because they do a lot of building. It's going to ruin the economy. It's just demonstrated. I think the U.S. was hoping that China would overreact. The idea that China was going to shoot down Pelosi's plane is pretty preposterous. It's certainly not in the nature of Chinese behavior around the world. But I think that's why the U.S. moved two carrier groups into the region. They were hoping for a big, dramatic reaction, if not shooting down, at least forcing down the plane. That didn't happen because that's not how China rolls, right? Just like how Russia, it's not how Russia rolls until it was forced to. And so they didn't get that. And so the gloves are off. And China says, okay, we can wait this out. We can cause economic pain. We can wait for elections and have a pro-reunification government.
Daniel, don't you find it really interesting, again, the parallel with Ukraine, is that the way the West, particularly the United States, talks about Russia's special military operation, that they're failing in all this. They always project what they would do. Oh, we would shoot down the plane, yes, but they would. Yeah. You know, that's, again, this kind of arrogance of projecting on to others here. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Taiwan. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Taiwan. Okay, let's go back to Andy in Beijing. Let's talk about China's reaction to the Pelosi trip. First of all, the Chinese leadership made it clear that they were not happy with this. And I always kind of like how the Chinese will say they're unhappy. That translates to furious in Western speak. I always kind of appreciate the tempered language from China. But, you know, there is a reaction going on right now. And it's, again, kind of an extending to my question, you know, if the rules don't apply anymore, China is going to be, let's just say, more creative here. And it looks to me it could be sustained and long term. I mean, the Americans might think this was a flash in the pan, poke them in the eye, you know, don't work with the Russians, nasty, nasty business that you're involved with, and then it would just kind of go away in the news cycle. No, I am looking at what's going on in the Straits. This is going to be a long haul for the very reason that I keep pointing out is that the Americans that have abandoned this policy. Maybe China won't do it unilaterally, but it's going to interpret that policy in a different way. Moving forward. My opinion, your thoughts, my friend in Beijing.
So, Peter, a little bit of, if I may, some historical context here. We look at the era of engagement, so where the U.S. wanted to work with China, but this was not for altruistic reasons.
Of course.
So, American politics is predicated, or I would say America's view of itself in the world is predicated on American leadership, hegemony. And the smart decision at the time for American elites, what we could call the blob, is that by co-opting China, what Jiang Zemin called peaceful evolution, through soft means, undermining China's sovereignty, that that would be the best way to ensure American hegemony. When they believe that that failed, this is, I think, why we're seeing this change. You know, I think what you're calling, and I think accurately calling, this abandonment of the one China policy, to a much harder-edged approach. So I think we should not discount the U.S. ability to pursue this kind of goal. And of course, as China rises, it is perhaps the only country in the world that can challenge American hegemony. So this is a very rational, even predictable response. And how is China responding to this? So I think that it's important to say that this talk of shooting down Pelosi's plane or intercepting it is not entirely an American invention. So there were Chinese voices, some very influential ones, like Hu Xijing, the former editor-in-chief of the Global Times, who said exactly that, that, you know, if the plane is not intercepted and doesn't turn around, it could be shot down. So certainly there are voices that are more hawkish. But I think what we see happening, to your point about the Chinese being very measured, I would say exhibiting both discipline and strategic patience, is look at what happened in Hong Kong in the unrest a few years ago. There were people in China saying that the PLA should go in to put down this unrest. But instead, what did China do? It enacted some systemic changes, like the passage of a national security law, that not only extinguished this foreign instigated unrest, but put Hong Kong on a sustainable path to stability and prosperity. So I think what we can see here is the policy of the U.S. is, well, the policy has not changed. I think the method has changed, but that how China will react again is long-term patience, resolute action that more than likely will result in Taiwan being reunified one way or another. But the big wild card, and I think, again, this is what makes it such a dangerous time for everybody, is that the U.S. cannot accept this result. Yep. We may see a war. The U.S. will attack China. Japan and Korea may be dragged in, just as other countries during World War I were dragged in against their will because they were locked into these alliances. And this could be a very, very bad outcome.
You know, Angela, in Hong Kong, before all this happened, strategic ambiguity was considered something good, okay? Basically, it was squaring the circle. The U.S. recognizes that Taiwan is part of China, though they could have some independent contact with Taiwan. And it kind of, you know, everybody, you know, parlayed, and it works. Now I think it's stopped working here. So strategic ambiguity is turning into a negative thing now. Go ahead, in Hong Kong.
But for China, it was never an ambiguity. China knew all along the long-term plan. This is not the first time that the U.S. is going against Chinese sovereignty. Andy just mentioned before in Hong Kong, the attempt of color revolution in Hong Kong was all sponsored back by the U.S. Additional to that, they were financing ETIM, the separatist Uyghurs in Xinjiang, and a lot of them are actually terrorists. The Dalai Lama has been financed by the CIA since the 1950s. So you see, this is not the first time that the U.S. is meddling into Chinese sovereignty. I like what Andy just mentioned before about Hong Kong. You see, what happened in Hong Kong is that China actually used the setback to turn it into an opportunity. Because of the riots they had in Hong Kong, they enacted a national security law, which, by the way, was signed, a petition was signed by 2.3 million people. So a very large majority of people, they signed, they backed Beijing for enacting this national security law. And this became actually a second handover, or actually maybe the real handover of Hong Kong to China, because there were lots of agents and lots of foreign meddling since 1997. So I am confident that actually what happened in Taiwan might actually turn into an opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, and Daniel, I'd like to point out to our other panelists and our viewers is that there were a lot of people in Taiwan protesting Pelosi's visit, okay? You didn't get that in the mainstream media, but there were quite a few people that weren't happy with it. Daniel, are we faced with the Thucydides trap right now? Is this being played out in real time?
I think you're absolutely right, Peter. And if I can just go back to one thing you said, I think you made a great point, which is the U.S. depends on a news cycle that is, you know, breathtakingly fast. There was a new Gallup poll that just came out showing that only 1% of Americans think that Russia is the biggest problem that we face right now. That's a huge decline from February. So we've already moved past that. We're going to have a week of Taiwan, and then we'll move past that. That's just how it works in the U.S. Pelosi has tried to frame this trip as some sort of grand, what did she say, democracy versus authoritarianism. It's this whole neocon idea that if the U.S. doesn't act across the world and make every country by force just like its own, the totalitarianism will triumph everywhere. And that just simply isn't the case. It's not been the case. All it's done is create a lot of heartache, and it's made the U.S. irrelevant because, as you rightly point out, this was not popular in Taiwan. I looked at the protests. People were afraid. They've seen what's happened in Ukraine. Yeah. They don't want to face this. And so it's failed. The U.S. is declining because it's afraid of declining. It's one of the most strangest. It's one of the strangest things in history, I think.
You know, Andy, I've been watching the Chinese military. It's quite formidable, and particularly since Taiwan is an island off the mainland, China has the advantage here. And it's creating an amazing amount of deterrence. I mean, it's not like going into Panama or Grenada, okay? And the last time, maybe Daniel can help me with this one, when's the last time the U.S. won a war? Maybe, you know, that's beside the point here. Though, you know, the what I'm getting at is that the U.S. military is good at attacking sheep herders, but not a major power like China. And I wonder if people in the Pentagon, if in their woke seminars, are realizing this. Go ahead, Andy.
Well, this is, again, I think what makes this such a grave and dangerous situation. Because I think, on the one hand, the U.S. military, of course, recognizes the risk that it faces. Every senior military official has said that the U.S. Cannot count on winning. Of course, the factors you mentioned, that Taiwan being so close to the mainland, Trump said this as well. But also, they need to consider the rapid advances that the PLA has made over the last 20 or 30 years since the last Taiwan Straits crisis. Also, strategically, I'll use a Bruce Lee quote here. So Bruce Lee said, "I do not fear the man who knows 10,000 kicks, but I do fear the man who has practiced one kick 10,000 times." Ooh. And what this means here is that the U.S. trains for missions all around the world, in the Middle East, in Latin America, in Europe. China really has one focus. That's Taiwan. So anti-area access denial missiles, submarines, all of this, the armaments, the doctrine, all the training is all oriented around one goal. So the U.S. military, of course, is very worried. We look at the war games that they've run. They say blue gets its ass handed to it every time, meaning yep. the U.S. loses every time. So clearly, on the one hand, the military recognizes the risk, but in a country with civilian leadership that is predicated on this notion of American exceptionalism and that American national security rests on being the global hegemon, again, the U.S. may have no choice. They're trapped in their ideology that may drive them to a destructive military conflict. Again, many people use the parallel.
Well, what's really interesting is that you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, but China's defending its sovereignty. That's something that is completely unacceptable for Washington. That's the tragedy of this exceptionalism here. That's all the time we have, gentlemen, here. I want to thank my guests in Beijing, Hong Kong, and in Lake Jackson. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here, RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.